Maven is, as you know, one who claims a degree of expertise outside of his major profession. I am not a maven when it comes to Greek vases, but somehow in the last weeks, such vases have been very much before my eyes and in my mind. You know, we went to Sicily in January. And during the years of the classical Greek civilizations, Sicily was dotted with all manner of Greek colonies. And the museums of Sicily are chock full with collections of Greek vases, those beautiful black-figured and red-figured vases which Athens produced, those very interesting geometrically designed vases which Corinth preferred. We saw a lot of these vases, of all sizes and of all shapes. They were very much on our mind, the more so because just a week or two before we had left, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York announced what it called the greatest acquisition in recent museum history. This acquisition, it turned out, was a red-figured Athenian vase, a rather sizable vase with handles, called a calyx crater, which had been done in the late 6th or early 5th centuries before the Common Era by a well-known Athenian master by the name of Euphronius. This vase is beautifully painted, and for anyone who didn't have the eyes to see its immediate worth, the Metropolitan made sure that we were duly impressed by signaling to the press that the vase had cost probably in excess of $1 million. Somehow there's a direct correlation between the price of an object and its artistic beauty. And normally, the acquisition of such a priceless object would be duly recorded in the critical columns of the New York Times and in the other art journals. It would pass into history, and we would go and see and enjoy and rejoice. But this particular vase was bought by the Metropolitan at a rather straitened time in its history. A number of employees had to be released. The Metropolitan seemed not to have the money with which to balance its budget. And there were all kinds of stories and rumors floating about. This great museum had sold or bartered away canvases by major contemporary artists. Why then, many asked, should such an extravagant price be paid for a Greek vase at a time when the Metropolitan seemed to have to sell some of its priceless masterpieces simply in order to make ends meet? The answer that Mr. Thomas Hoving, the director of the Metropolitan, made was that this vase was a genuine masterpiece and that the canvases, the pictures that they had sold, were not masterpieces, that though they had been done by first-rate painters, they were not among their best work. And that the Metropolitan was so chocked full of great art that it simply could not retain in its stores these particular pictures. The problem with this claim was that at least one of these canvases which had been sold had been featured in a recent Metropolitan exhibition of masterworks of modern painting. And there ensued in the public press and among the art, in the art world, a very lively debate as to what is a masterpiece and what is not. Does not a museum have a responsibility to retain objects of quality which have been given them, to keep them out of the vagaries and uncertainties of private possession of a market? More than this, aren't there swings of taste? Couldn't what we pass off as a second-level work by a major artist, in fact appear in other eyes at other times to be one of his or her most important pictures. So the debate blew up. There was a great brouhaha. And about 3 weeks ago, when in New York, I freed an hour between meetings, and I went up to the Metropolitan Museum to see the great Greek crater. I got no further than the door of the very large oval room in which this vase now is exhibited in solitary splendor. The room was filled with television equipment, with crews, and with Dr. Bobin. He was standing in front of the pedestal on which the vase stood, and he was answering questions posed to him by an eager group of television commentators who wanted to know if this great Greek vase wasn't, in fact, a hot pot, because just that day the Italian police had released the news that they had requested of the New York police and of the FBI support in continuing their investigations as to into illegal diggings in Etruscan grave sites north of Rome. Six men had been arraigned in Italy. One of these had confessed that he had dug out a pot not unlike the one now in exhibit in the Metropolitan Museum some 2 years ago. Had the Metropolitan exhibited a vase which had been illegally dug and obviously illegally brought out of Italy? Mr. Hoving was answering these reporters by saying no, they had bought the vase through a very reputable agent with whom they dealt with many times in the past, and that this agent was acting on behalf of a well-known art collector in whose hands this euphonious vase had rested for many decades. Unfortunately, again for the Metropolitan, it turned out that when the agent's name was released, he was a member of the senior under art world. He had already been expelled from Turkey for engaging in illegal smuggling of archaeological objects. And the collector or dealer in the Lebanon, who admitted freely that he had had the vase in his possession and his father before him, in so doing denied the Metropolitan's claim that one of the great values of this vase was its pristine quality. It was all of a piece, unlike most vases which are broken under the weight of the ground and have to be repaired. He said that the vase had existed in some 14 major pieces in a shelf in his father's shop for some decades. There were a number of cracks which had had to be replaced. There was a good deal of repainting and retouching that had to be done, and they hadn't thought it worthwhile to do all of this until very, very recent times. Well, that's the background of the hot pot or the Greek masterwork, call it what you will. Now, I followed this with a mixture of interest, obviously, and also with a good degree of distaste. I've always felt that somehow exposure to a great work of beauty ought to bring out the best in the human soul, not the most venal, the grossest. But in any case, being a rabbi, I couldn't resist thinking of this great Greek vase, and it is a first-class piece of work, and comparing it to the products of our own culture at about the same time. For between Greece and Palestine, between the Hellenic and the Hebraic civilizations, we have the full level, the full measure of the foundations of Western civilization. And it's fascinating to speculate, and men have speculated endlessly, and I think we'll do so for endless time, as to why these particular groups of people had different kinds of interests and exhibit different kinds of talent and of accomplishment. If you wander through the fascinating Israel Museum in Jerusalem, you'll see displayed for you in room after room all the artifacts which have been dug up from Judea and Israel during the last several decades by the archaeologists. There are ivories and there are column heads and there are architectural designs of ancient buildings. There is pottery. There are scarabs. There are rings. are glass vessels. Many of you have seen this very fantastic and large display. But look throughout the museum, and you'll not find a single vase, a single piece of art of the quality, of the first-rate quality of the Euphronius vase or of other vases of this type. Pottery tends to be functional. The glazes tend to be simple. Somehow the Hebraic civilization simply did not invest that degree of artistic talent onto these objects, which the Greek civilization did. And correspondingly, as you read the literature of Greece, as you read its prophetic literature, its ethical literature, you'll not find prophecies or statements or sermons or ethical essays from the 6th or 5th centuries of the quality of those of Deutero Isaiah that I read to you this morning, or of Haggai or of Malachi, who were the contemporaries of Euphronius in Jerusalem at the same time that Euphronius was active in Athens. Prophecy in Greece at this time was at the level of the oracles of Delphi or the oracles of Olympus. Soothsayer riddles and portents, fascinating in their implications, sometimes historically important in terms of the decisions, political and military, that they led Greeks to take. But none of them talk deeply to the human civilization, human situation, as do the great statements of our Hebrew prophets. Now, why should this be so? Many have speculated in the past that the reason that Greek prophecy did not reach the heights of Hebraic prophecy was simply that by the time that the classic Greek civilization emerges, the Greeks had really emerged from religious preoccupation. The myths belonged to the Homeric age. In ancient times, the 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th century, Greece, like all the countries of activity, had been a pagan, idolatrous, believing, polytheistic civilization. But by the time of the emergence of the classical civilization, according to this theory, Greece had relatively freed itself of the fear of the gods, of concern with the gods. The sacrifices were entered into out of sheer habit or custom. And since religious preoccupations, the preoccupation with the divine, were not significant, Greece was preoccupied with the relations of man to man, of man to nature. It created the great science and the great analytic philosophies of modern times. Unfortunately for this theory, those who have studied Greece more carefully more recently have pointed out that far from having disencumbered itself of religious undertakings, Greek civilization right down to Roman times remained deeply concerned with the supernatural. No Greek senate, no Greek leader took any major military or political decision without consulting the oracles. The great bleached statues which we now see in our museum were once highly painted, surrounded by priests and altars on which sacrifices smoked, bowed to and kneeled before and prayed to by the myriads of the citizens of the Greek cities. Priests and soothsayers and oracles moved freely about Greece. And even such a great caustic and cynical philosopher, Socrates, admits to having had a little god who perched on his shoulder and whispered into his ear when he needed some analytic truth with which to answer his controversialists. Greece remained a religious community right down through its history. And if it failed to produce great documents of religious merit or worth, the answer does not lie in its indifference to the religious undertaking, but its lack of creative talent, of depth in religious pursuit. And the reverse can be equally argued. The old explanation of why Israel did not have a Euphronius was a second commandment. God himself had dammed up the creative artistic spirit of the Jew when he had ordered the Jew, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor any manner of likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or the earth below, or the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them." Israel was not to make any graven image, any statue in the round, any representational art, any idol or icon. And prohibited from this kind of undertaking, the Jewish artistic spirit simply dried up. There was no outlet for its creative energy. Men believed this right down through the 19th century. And then in our own century, ancient Jewish art was rediscovered. Around 1900, a man by the name of David Kaufman began going through the great libraries of the Vatican, of the Escorial, of the Louvre, and he just rediscovered there those magnificent medieval miniatures which Jews had painted on and around their Bibles, Maimonides, Mishneh Torah, their Haggadahs, and their prayer books. The reason that none existed in later times was that the church had simply gone off all of them during the period of the Inquisition and of the persecution. And in medieval Europe, the Jews had been forbidden by the Christian guilds to enter an artist's atelier, to enter a goldsmith's workshop, and the talent had been denied them, the opportunity to acquire the raw material had been denied them, and so they had simply, the artistic spirit had withered for economic and apartheid reasons, not for religious reasons. And some years later, Dr. Solomon Schechter, later founder of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, while in Cairo, discovered the great repository of Egyptian documents from the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries from the Geniza. And among these documents, most of them legal and religious, there were found any number of magnificently illuminated marriage contracts, kestuvot, some very beautifully illuminated prayer books, particularly the prayer books for the high holidays, sheets of prayer from other liturgies, and it was seen that it was not only in the Spanish Jewish world, but in the Egyptian Jewish world as well, that there had been a rather free expression of artistry. And then in the 1920s, first at Naanan, and then at Beit Alpha, and then elsewhere in Palestine, archaeologists began to unearth the foundations of synagogues in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries of the Common Era. And lo and behold, on the floor, in mosaic, one found not only geometric design, but one found all of the symbols of the zodiac. One found figures of Abraham offering Isaac a sacrifice, and Moses leading the children of Israel out of Egypt. And even in the center of one of these floors at Beit Alpha, inside the signs of the zodiac, one sees Apollo riding the horses of the sun across the heavens. Now, these floors were in pious synagogues, synagogues of observant Jews. And the sages and people who worshiped there not only stood on these floors, but knelt on them. We bow the head and bend the knee, and they prostrated themselves there unto God, though it would seem to violate the second commandment. And then in the 1930s, in a Syrian city, Dura Europus, archaeologists excavated a great synagogue, which had existed there in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries. And lo and behold, to everybody's surprise, the walls were not bare, but in that square or rectangular room, the walls were painted in bands from floor to ceiling with series of episodes from major segments of the biblical story. There was Abraham, there was Isaac, there was Jacob, there was Moses and the children of Israel, there was Miriam singing at the other side of the Red Sea, there was the valley of the dry bones and the resurrection of the community. All of these scenes painted in tears. There wasn't a bit of empty space on the walls of the synagogue. And finally, in more recent times, we've had the great systematic excavation of Israel by the modern generation of archaeologists. We recognize that way back in biblical times, Israel had disfigured coins, Israel had its various religious symbols, Israel had painted pottery, that there has been a Jewish art since the very beginning. And as historians went back and re-examined the documents, because they were forced to do so by the artifacts which had emerged, they recognized that in most periods of their history, Jews had interpreted the Second Commandment rather narrowly. That is, the Jew was prohibited from making images in the round, statues, provided these were for religious purpose. But otherwise, except at periods when the surrounding culture was itself anti-image, aniconic, as during the Byzantine age, when there were the great iconoclastic struggles, as in Muslim times. Except in those periods, our artists had more or less freely exhibited such artistic talents as they possessed. Yet the fact remains that as prophecy and preachment in Greece were relatively second rate, so the art of ancient Israel was relatively second rate. How shall we explain this, the difference in emphases in the two cultures? The answer, I think, lies in the way in which the two cultures had trained themselves, had conditioned themselves to see life. The Greek was conditioned, for reasons that are hard to understand now, to see life in its variety. He saw the trees and the spirit that animated the tree. He saw the brook, he saw the mountain, he saw the sun, he saw the wind, he saw the clouds. He saw all the powers of nature, their brilliance and their magnificence, their power, their ability to grow. And he responded to these, and out of that response, he developed his animistic, his pantheistic faith, the great mythologies which are at the base of his culture. He saw the variety and its beauty, the particularity of things. He saw the particularity of men. There were Greeks and there were barbarians. He saw the difference between the races of men, the gross scientific differences, the color of one's hair, the color of one's skin, the shape of one's eye, the stature of one's being. And he divided men as he divided nature into species, into classes, but he saw the difference rather than the unity. The difference fascinated him and intoxicated him. He tried to express it in his art. And the Jew, again for reasons which are not quite clear, saw not so much the diversity as the unity. He saw all the objects of nature, which science in his day taught him were separate and distinct. No one was able yet to see the basic substratum of energy, the atoms and molecules which somehow unite in one pulsating being all of life. Science spoke of difference, but somehow the Judean civilization saw behind difference to unity, behind the moment to eternity. A representational art, Euphronius's art, is an art that glories in the moment. It glories in uniqueness. It glories in the meeting. It glories in all that can happen at a given point in time. It sees the object and something of the quality of the object, the meeting and something of the tension in the meeting. Non-representational art, symbolic art, looks behind the object to the meaning, behind the moment to the implications. Somehow in our Jewish tradition, our people were conditioned to look behind the moment to what enlivens it, to the unity which binds all natural objects and all mankind together. To the Greek, all races were separate. To the Jew, it was, have we not all one Father? And hath not one God created us all? Let's look at the vase. The vase has on it two great scenes. Both scenes are taken from the Iliad, the great poem of the ancient Argives, the war of the Greek city-states against Troy. Both have to do with an ally of Troy by the name of Serapion, who was king of Lycia, descendant of Zeus, one of the great classic heroes of Greek antiquity. The reverse side of the vase shows Serapion and some of his young princes from Lycia buckling on their armor, getting ready for war. The Iliad tells us that among all the heroes who came to Troy, none was more willing to dare in the fight against the enemy, to be brave. None was more abler in battle than Serapion. It also tells us in the last year of the war, this hero was moved to be caustic with his Trojan allies because it was their battle. He had come to help them, and he was always in the forefront of the battle, and they were always behind. His time had come to die. He had shown a degree of arrogance, let us say. And he leads one great last attack against the Greeks, He's able to burn a number of the Greek ships, and then he's struck down by one of the Greek warriors, Patroclus, and the scene that's on the front of the vase is of the naked body of Serapion, bleeding. He is dead, and his body is being picked up by two winged beings to be borne away, and over it all there is the figure of Apollo watching and commanding the proceedings. Zeus had seen the death of his heroic son. He had seen the Greeks strip the body of its armor, but he was determined that the heroism of the man should not go unrewarded. He had commanded Apollo to go down to oversee this operation. And Apollo had brought with him Hypnos and Thanatos, sleep and death, and these two winged beings had carried the body of the hero to a river whose fresh water had mollified the wounds, and they brought back the body of the hero to his own city, where it was buried with appropriate rites. Now, these two scenes in this vase obviously say a great deal. They remind us of a moment which was beloved to the Greeks from their ancient saga. They tell us something of the nature of heroism and of the fact that the gods will ultimately reward the hero. They tell us something of the obligations which a hero takes upon himself. Serapion had not needed to respond as he did to the call of Troy for support, but he had responded. They tell us something of the care with which heroes must be handled, how their funeral rites must be appropriately tendered, all ideas, ethical values of concern to the Greeks. But there is nothing that ties these ethical perceptions the moment together. It remains a distinct moment in time. It is placed, these images are placed on a great vessel, which has no other purpose than to be present at a banquet by some rich Greek, as a vessel in which he can mix wine and water together to serve to his guests. And the vessel is appropriately inscribed with the artist's name and the potter's name to certify to its value, the same way we insist that a print have the signature of the man who was the original designer, artist. And interestingly, as if to complete the picture of the immediacy of the worldliness of this particular understanding, there is one other inscription on the vase: Leandros Kalos, which means simply, "True Leander, my lover." Leander was obviously a youth, a young boy, with whom the artist was in love, and with whom he had a typical Greek relationship. Somehow, this homosexual Greek relationship, the banquet, concepts of heroism, are all confused together in a single great work of art. Even as life is confused for all of us. We try to understand what we must do. We live in the real world. We relate in terms of our real feelings. And all of this remains to us, that which our senses take in, a representation of the world as we know it. Now turn to the contemporary of Euphronius, the unknown prophet of the exile, Deutero-Isaiah. Deutero-Isaiah, interestingly, was very much concerned with art. He very much misprized the artist. Among all the poetic segments which come to us from Deutero-Isaiah, there's one short paragraph in prose in the 44th chapter, which is called usually an essay on idolatry. But it's really not simply an attack on idolatry, it's an attack on the artist. He says, all the artisans are as nothing, they're as ciphers. They never work except for money. They never pour the bronze for the statues except for the expectations of wages. They all ought to be ashamed of themselves, and they ought to be red-faced. Now, why does he attack the artist? Because in the ancient world, the economics of art were simply this, as they are today. One needs to feed one's children even if one is an artist. To whom can one sell one's art? One sells one's art to a rich patron. Why does the patron buy the art? He may wish it to adorn his home, but more likely at a time when there is not that much money, he buys it as a donation, as a gift to the temple, that his God may be worshipped in the beauty of holiness, and that he may be granted immortality in the world to come. As he has given to his God, so his God will return to him. Most art was associated with the pagan cults, and most artists were therefore suspect in Deutero Isaiah's eyes of somehow being involved in the idolatrous enterprise. But more than this, as you read Deutero Isaiah, you find in him the Hebraic view so different than the Hellenic view. The Hellenic view saw the individual, it saw the moment, it saw the meeting. The Hebraic view saw behind the moment, behind the individual, behind the meeting, to the spirit which unites all mankind, to the creative purpose of the universe, to God. Listen to one of the great preachments of Euphronius' contemporary. Who has measured the waters in the palm of his hand, or with its span set limits to the heaven? Who has held all the soil of the earth in a bushel, or weighed the mountains on a balance and the hills on a pair of scales? Who has set limits to the Spirit of the Lord? What counselor stood at his side to instruct him? With whom did he confer to gain discernment? Who taught him how to do justice or gave him lessons in wisdom? Why to him nations are but drops from a bucket, no more than moisture in the scales? Coasts and islands weigh as lights, as specks of dust. All Lebanon does not yield wood enough for fuel, or beasts enough for a sacrifice. All nations dwindle to nothing before him. God reckons them mere nothings, less than naught. What likeness will you find for God? What form to resemble him? Is it an image which a craftsman can set up, or a goldsmith cover with plate, or fit with studs of silver as with a costly gift? Or is it mulberry wood that will not rot, which a man chooses, seeking out a skillful craftsman for it, to mount an image that will not fall? Each workman helps the other. Each man encourages his fellow. The craftsman urges on the goldsmith. The gilder urges the man who beats the anvil. He declares the soldering to be good. He fastens the image with nails so that it does not fall down. But do you not know, have you not heard, were you not told long ago? Have you not perceived ever since the world began that God sits enthroned on the vaulted roof of the earth, whose inhabitants are like grasshoppers? He stretches out the skies like a curtain. He spreads them out like a tent to live under. He reduces the great to nothing and makes all earth's princes less than nothing. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely are they taken root in the earth before he blows upon them and they wither away. The whirlwind carries them off like chaff. To whom then will you liken me? Whom set up as an equal? Asks the Holy One of Israel. El mi te damuni. Whom will you liken me? All the people of this earth, all the individuals, all the great historic moments, all the princes who manipulate men, all the men, tyrants who have power, these are as grasshoppers, as nothing. See behind power to the real power, which is God. See behind the beauty of the natural object to the truly beautiful, which is the Spirit of God. This capacity, which is implicit in the vision of Deutero Isaiah, is the unique capacity of the visions of Israel. Now, we had our craftsmen. We had our men who made the great symbolic objects, the ark, tabernacle, the tent of meeting. Interestingly, at the very time when Euphronius was busy in Athens, a number of Judeans were coming back from the Babylonian exile to Jerusalem to reestablish there the temple, and they were bringing with them all the great holy objects, the menorah, the table for the showbread, the other symbolic objects which had featured the Temple of Solomon. And these were to be reestablished in the second temple in Jerusalem. And artisans and carpenters and craftsmen of all kinds came back with these Judeans to rebuild the temple. We had artisans, but our artisans were somehow reduced to dealing with that which was simply symbolic, designed, which bespoke the word of God rather than the reality of the real world, which saw behind the moment to the eternal. The great symbol of the sanctuary was a great golden menorah, tall, seven-branched, each branch having great designs on it. It was the tree of life. It was the 7 days of the week. It was the seven planets of the universe. It bespoke of growth, of light, of life, of the unity of all. This kind of symbolism is both grand, pregnant with meaning, and terribly limiting to an artist. He wants to deal with variety, not simply again and again with the same pattern, the same object. Yet something in the Jewish tradition said, only these objects and these symbols will somehow convey the unity of God, brotherhood of man, the unity of the moral law, the universal obligation of God's law for all men. And there you have it, I think, part of the explanation of the difference between civilizations of Greece and of Rome. It's not a question of better and of lesser. Both are needed. We live in the real world, we live among people. We need to delight in the possibilities of the everyday. We also live in God's world. We need to delight ourselves in the meaning of God's divine plan and to be reminded again and again of its obligation. It's a good thing in the last analysis that our civilization is a compound, a blend of Greece and of Jerusalem, of Athens and of the Promised Land. And there are two very different and very specific visions. One, full of variety, full of movement, full of life, full of man, the other full of meaning and depth and of God. Would that both could be pursued in holiness. Amen.